There is no way to combat the poisonous influences of perverse doctrine but to meet it head on. The call of God to Asa in the passage that we have read this evening was that he must confront the need to do the work of God. In the chapter that precedes, we find the record of Asa's accession to the throne of Judah, and that he was one of the good kings of that southern kingdom. The northern kingdom had no such good kings, but the southern kingdom did have some. Asa was one, and his policy was to try to bring about a revival in the land. But the initial phase of his reign was taken up with warfare. In chapter 14, we have his famous prayer when they were outnumbered. It's nothing to the Lord to help with many or with few. And they were given a great deliverance. And it's following that that we find the verses that we read this evening and the exhortation of a prophet. Not a prophet whose name is attached to any prophecy in the scriptures, but a prophet nonetheless. And he came out in the wake of Asa's great initial victory to exhort him to continue on in his policy of seeking after the Lord. If we had the time to read on in chapter 15, we would find the notable covenant that the people made together, that covenant of revival by which they resolved to put away all of the false gods out of the land. But there was being communicated to Asa a need for strength and resolve. A need for the commitment to continue on as he had begun, to continue on laboring for God and his truth. And that to do so, as the prophet said in verse 7, would yield rich rewards. Those are memorable words. Be ye strong, therefore. And let not your hands be weak. Might be one thing to have strength of resolve in the mind, but sometimes the practical application is allowed to slide. Let not your hands be weak. Your work shall be rewarded. However difficult it is, however costly it is, the word of the prophet was, Asa, your work is going to be rewarded. Now, when we look at the history of Presbyterianism in the United States, we find the need for a similar exhortation. Now, it would be foolish to pretend that Presbyterian history is concerned only with events in the United States. It's not. Scotland has its own Presbyterian history. Ireland has its own Presbyterian history. Canada, to some extent, has its own Presbyterian history. But I think it is because the culture of the United States and its style of government are most reflective of Presbyterian ideals that this country became the scene of so much Presbyterian development. But the battles began very early. At the end of the last message in this series, I referred to the Second Great Awakening, that revival, much more widespread than the First Great Awakening during colonial times, the Second Great Awakening beginning around 1800, continuing to varying degrees in different places for the first three decades of the 19th century. And it was really, I think if historians would be candid, which not many of them are, but I think it would be well to admit that it was the move of God in the Second Great Awakening that firmly established the American government and what is called the American experiment. But after about 30 years in the 19th century, Charles Finney began to engage in his ministry. Finney had been ordained as a Presbyterian minister. And as such, he had subscribed the Westminster Confession of Faith as a confession of his own faith. But the views that he came to hold were far removed from what he had subscribed. And his labors began to dilute the impact of the Second Great Awakening and soon caused it to fade away. Finney advocated what he called new measures in theology. But what he subscribed was really an attack on basic, historic, Presbyterian theology. That theology emphasized the total depravity and the total inability of the human soul in the matter of salvation. Finney criticized the efforts of the noted preachers of the Second Great Awakening, men like Azahel Nettleton. He criticized them for not employing measures to stir the people up emotionally so that they would make decisions for Christ. People like Nettleton were of the view that the Spirit of God must apply the truth of the word to the hearts of those who heard it. It was during this same period of time, the 1830s, that the pernicious effects of German liberalism began to affect the Church of Scotland and led to the famous disruption of 1843, to which we've had cause to refer in our series on Horatius Bonar. In that year of 1843, Thomas Chalmers, the professor of theology in the Assembly College, led about 400 of his fellow ministers, including the Bonar brothers, to withdraw from the Church of Scotland and to form a new Presbyterian denomination in Scotland. And that would be called the Free Church of Scotland. So there was the Church of Scotland, and then the Free Church of Scotland. Now, that took place in 1843. In 1843, as those events were transpiring, Charles Hodge, by this time in his 40s, a graduate of Princeton Seminary in New Jersey, had returned from time spent some years before in Europe, during which he had studied as well under some of the same seminary professors in France and in Germany who had wrought such a devastating effect in Scotland. But Hodge retained his theological integrity. And he became, when he returned to the United States, the most visible defender of Presbyterian orthodoxy in this country. Now, Hodge's life was divided by the war between the states. And the effects of that war led to a division in Presbyterianism, a division between the northern and southern parts of the Presbyterian Church. Charles Hodge became the most well-known representative of the northern, or as they came to be called, the United Presbyterians. Robert Dabney became the most well-known representative of the southern Presbyterians, although there were many other Southern Presbyterians who were equally famous and who were contemporary with him. Now, the aftermath of the war between the states produced profound effects in American society. And Presbyterianism was no exception. It soon became evident that there was going to be a battle for the future of Presbyterianism. That battle would be more accelerated in the North than in the South, but ultimately it would affect both sections. And initially, it was a battle that would be conducted in the classrooms and through the publications of Princeton Seminary. The battle that began there in the latter years of the 19th century would have extensive implications that would continue to be felt into the early years of the 21st century. We're coming this evening to the section of Presbyterian history that will concern us much more closely. And so we come to what I call Presbyterian History, Part 3. Now, it's been some time since we dealt with this subject, so let's just review. We surveyed in our first message on Presbyterian history the history of Presbyterianism all the way back to the Apostolic Age, where the New Testament makes it plain that the church was governed in the Apostolic Age under Presbyterian principles. We've also considered the work of John Knox and his successors at the time of the Protestant Reformation in Scotland, where they reinstituted, if you will, Presbyterian government in the church. We gave attention as well to the work of the Westminster Assembly and the transmission of the Presbyterian legacy to the New World. We also gave attention to the covenanting period in Scotland and the sacrifices that were made there for the principles of the Presbyterian Reformation. Then we considered the role that Presbyterians and their ideas played in the development of the colonies in North America and in the formation of the United States and the establishment of its government as a constitutional republic. Very strong Presbyterian influences in all of these areas. Now, I think I said in a message earlier in the series that obviously there are other denominational bodies that use Presbyterian concepts in government. But we're not dealing with them, strictly speaking, because there are other influences in those bodies as well. Now, the broad sweep of Presbyterian history really prevents us from being anything like thorough in our treatment of it for our purposes in this series. As I have suggested, there are key sections of that history that I'm really not going to deal with at all. And even in this message, there's going to be a lot of skipping of aspects of the history. So if there's something that you're hoping to hear and you don't hear it, well, you'll understand that it's because I'm trying to focus on a certain idea in this history. I want to focus your attention on four aspects of Presbyterian history that really deal with the 20th century with a background reaching into the 19th century and the 21st century as well. And the first aspect is the battle against German rationalism. I spoke about the struggle that was going to come. There were twin evils in German seminaries late in the 18th century and into the 19th century, and those twin evils began to invade Protestant seminaries elsewhere. As people were trained there, to be professors, and they went to these other places and began to teach. That which was being taught in the German seminaries was something called higher criticism. Now, higher criticism, as it invaded various seminaries, initiated a conflict to which successive generations of theologians would devote their careers. The German higher criticism included two primary components. First was the documentary hypothesis, as it was called, for dealing with the Old Testament. And then form criticism, as it was called, for dealing with the New Testament. Now, I'm oversimplifying. I don't want to get too involved in this aspect of the message, but just so that you understand what the battle was about. The documentary hypothesis suggested that the books of the Old Testament were assembled by editors on the basis of traditions that had been transmitted orally through the centuries from generation to generation, that the books of the Old Testament were written very late in the history of that period. Well, you can imagine what the idea was. It was to deny, first of all, the inspiration of the Old Testament. It was to deny, secondly, that there was anything authoritative about the Old Testament statements about creation and other matters. And obviously, it was to suggest that the Old Testament was full of mistakes. Because if they were relying on oral tradition transmitted through the centuries, and that these traditions were compiled very late, there were going to be errors and gaps. So they were attacking the doctrine of inspiration. Sometimes the documentary hypothesis is known by four letters that are applied to the first five books of the Old Testament. J-E-D-P. That is, some sections they detected a Jehovist editor. Other sections, an Elohist editor. For other sections, they referred to as the Deuteronomy editor. And then other sections they dealt with by saying they were edited by priests, so that these sections they claimed to be able to determine. And that was a way in which they could carve up the Old Testament. Now, form criticism adopted a similar foundation for dealing with the New Testament. It would suggest that the Gospels were not written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John at all, but that they were concocted by Christ's followers at a later time. Again, on the basis of oral tradition. Stories that had been passed from one generation to the next. And so they said that much of what had been written about Christ could not be trusted. The chief spokesman of the Form Critics was a man named F.C. Bauer, B-A-U-R. And he said it was necessary to consider every aspect of the New Testament in order to determine what Jesus actually said. In other words, that many of the things he is attributed, he is reputed to have said, he did not say. They said that there were many things attributed to Jesus by his sincere but overly zealous followers that they had just invented. So those were the evils that were threatening the Protestant seminaries, not the least of which was Princeton. And against these evils, the leaders of Princeton Seminary and others with them waged theological warfare in the latter portion of the 19th century. There were times, I am sorry to have to say, when ground was given away. And especially was that the case after the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859. And that was ground that could not be recovered afterward. There were Orthodox theologians who were anxious not to appear to be in conflict with the new scientific ideas, and so they accommodated their view of the Bible to those ideas. But there were four Princeton stalwarts, that I call them, who strove to uphold the foundations of Presbyterian orthodoxy in succeeding generations. I have spoken of Charles Hodge. Charles Hodge was born in 1797. That's the year when John Adams became the second president of the United States. Hodge lived until 1878. So if your math is good, you can figure out he lived to be 81 years of age. In 1819, he graduated from Princeton Seminary. And you can gather the regard with which he was held by his professors in that they asked him immediately to begin teaching there in the seminary. And in 1822, they made him the seminary's first professor of Oriental and Biblical literature. He had a facility for language, and it was in the area of language that he studied when he went to Europe. In 1840, he assumed the responsibility for teaching theology, and he continued doing that until his death. In the latter years of his life, it fell to him to go into print to challenge the assertions of Darwinism. But once again, there was a weakness betrayed here in that Hodge wrote that he didn't think there was necessarily any conflict between evolution and religion. And it was a concession like that that opened the door for other things subsequently. Hodge's role in battling German rationalism could be seen in the careers of those who followed him, one of whom he trained in a very personal way. That was his son, A.A. Hodge, Archibald Alexander Hodge, named for the first president of Princeton Seminary. A.A. Hodge was born in 1823. And he lived until 1886. He studied at Princeton Seminary and then had a career in missionary labor in India and then subsequently in pastorates in Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. And as a professor at Western Theological Seminary in Pittsburgh. In 1877, he was called to take up the chair of theology at Princeton. And so he and his father taught together there in the last year of his father's life. And he continued doing that until his death, and he died only 8 years after his father. A.A. Hodge was most well known for his book Outlines of Theology, and for his excellent commentary on the Westminster Confession of Faith. It was his desire, as a minister, as a seminary professor, as a writer, to defend the historic Presbyterianism that his father had labored so diligently to preserve and to instill in him, and to stand against the suggestions of German liberalism. A.A. Hodge trained a man who ultimately succeeded him, and that was B.B. Warfield. B.B. Warfield, Benjamin Warfield, was born in 1851, so is another generation removed, another generation following. He lived until 1921. In 1881, Warfield collaborated with A.A. Hodge on an article that asserted the view that the ideas that the Bible was without error, that the idea that the Bible was without error was nothing more than Orthodox Christianity. Because there were people who were suggesting that those who were suddenly saying the Bible was without error, that this was a new idea that had never been propounded before, and that it was an idea invented to prevent the spread of Darwinism. So they wrote that the Bible was without error and that this was not a new idea. Warfield was involved in writing against modernistic trends in Presbyterianism, and he took his stand in his life against purveyors of modernism like Harry Emerson Fosdick, who preached in New York. Warfield urged that people would rely on the Scriptures. He observed the trend that had developed that people like Fosdick were the ones to whom others were looking for an understanding of what the Bible said. They were relying on interpreters of the Bible instead of going to the Bible itself. Warfield was to provide a heavy influence on the last of these four Princeton stalwarts, J. Gresham Machen. J. Gresham Machen was born in 1881, 30 years after Warfield. So you see Charles Hodge, 1797, A.A. Hodge, 1823, Warfield, 1851, and then Machen, 1881. He lived until 1937. Now, you may recall from Reverend DiCanio's documentary, Here I Stand, Part 1, that there is mention there of Machen's involvement in what came to be called the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. And while Machen never really cared to be called a fundamentalist, he did take his side on that side of the controversy. And that was a struggle that became the precursor to what was called, by those who were in favor of it, the reorganization of Princeton Seminary, but what was called by Machen and others the collapse of Princeton Seminary, and that happened in 1929, the same year as the stock market crash that triggered the Great Depression. In 1929, then, Princeton was effectively lost as a bastion against German rationalism. Now, later, Machen, as you may recall from that documentary, was put on trial by the Presbyterian Church over the controversy over the mission board, and he was convicted of heresy and schism and was expelled from the denomination, along with some of his protégés. So that's the first aspect of this part of the history, the battle against German rationalism. And while the battle was eventually lost in terms of Princeton, they didn't give up the fight. And so we come to the second aspect now, and that is the struggle to preserve Presbyterian orthodoxy. Machen and his protégés, two of them I will mention here in particular, Charles Woodbridge, who was born in 1902, and Carl McIntyre, who was born in 1905. They were also removed, along with Machen, from the United Presbyterian Church. And when that happened, they decided to form a new seminary and a new denomination. Now, I never met Carl McIntyre, but I did meet in person and benefit in person from the ministry of Charles Woodbridge when I was a student in college. He came and taught in two different years on books of the Bible, and I was able to be part of those classes. So I have some immediate contact in my memory with one who was part of this struggle. They decided that they would form a new seminary and a new denomination. Now, the seminary was the first thing to be formed. That was Westminster Theological Seminary, established in Philadelphia. And later the denomination, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, came into being in 1936. Now, you may remember, Machen died in 1937, so he did not live very long after these events took place. And some have speculated that perhaps the fact that Machen did not live very long after that may have been the reason that the new denomination and the seminary had difficulty getting a foundation. Well, whatever the reason, some years later, in 1952, Carl McIntyre departed from the Orthodox Presbyterian Church and founded the Bible Presbyterian Church and Faith Theological Seminary, also in Philadelphia. But again, the Bible Presbyterians, because of various distractions, had trouble becoming effective. They did some good things, but they always had some problems becoming effective. The third aspect of this history to which I draw your attention, I call the inroads of compromise. One of the students that became part of Westminster Seminary, you may remember seeing his picture in the same group with Carl McIntyre, was Harold Ockenghay. Harold Ockenghay would become, in the 1940s, the founder of a new movement that would be called the New Evangelicalism. The New Evangelicalism had a different philosophy than, by implication, the Old Evangelicalism, which came to be called Fundamentalism. The Old Evangelicalism had the philosophy of maintaining a separatist position, not engaging in dialogue with those who had departed from the faith. The New Evangelicalism, seeking recognition for intellectual achievement, wanted to engage in these dialogues, in these compromises. Now, when the New Evangelicalism was formed, there was already in existence an organization that became its organ, and that was the National Association of Evangelicals, the NAE. Now, there was a rival group that had been established at the same time, established through the efforts of Carl McIntyre, and that group was known as the American Council of Christian Churches. Now, you begin to see where all this history is leading. Now, there would come to be at least two Presbyterian denominations that would become part of the NAE. One, the Reformed Presbyterian Church, sometimes known as the Covenanters. Their motto is "For Christ's Crown and Covenant." They are known for not using musical instruments and for singing only the Psalms in their worship. They're part of the NAE and the Presbyterian Church in America, or the PCA. The PCA was formed in 1973 as a secession from the Southern Presbyterian Church over the issues of liberalism in theology. But the PCA also had trouble becoming established with any kind of consistent identity, and its decision to become part of the NAE marked it as being not a separatist work. So there was the third aspect of this history, and that was the inroads of compromise. Now we come to the fourth aspect, and I have very little time to devote to it, what I call the revival of fundamentalist Presbyterianism. And here's the story of the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster. The Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster, as you may recall, was begun in 1951. It was the result of a departure from the Irish Presbyterian Church. The Irish Presbyterian Church was the result of ministry by churches in Scotland. The Irish Presbyterian Church had affiliated with the World Council of Churches in 1948. And so the Free Presbyterian Church began as a separation from the Irish Presbyterian Church. And so just as it had been in Scotland, the Church of Scotland and the Free Church of Scotland, so in Northern Ireland, you had the Irish Presbyterian Church and then the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster, to emphasize that it was a departure from the other church. Now, the Free Presbyterian Church of North America began in 1976 in Toronto. And you know some of that history. Dr. McClelland, you have heard, came to Toronto in that year and basically took the remnants of a Bible Presbyterian congregation and with that group began the work of establishing a Free Presbyterian Church. There was much opposition, but eventually the church became established and today occupies an impressive property in the city of Toronto. But that began the process of the development of the Free Presbyterian Church of North America. Faith Free Presbyterian Church in Greenville, South Carolina, came into the denomination in 1977. The church in Pennsylvania, which began at Newtown Square, Pennsylvania, was begun in 1978. And there was a church in Western Canada, in Calgary, that began, I think, in 1980 or 81. I don't remember the exact year offhand. But those were initial works in the Free Presbyterian Church of North America. And then the years that followed featured the continuing development of that church. And that which was true of the Free Presbyterian movement was that it harked back to the old days of maintaining a strongly separatist position when it came to infidelity and liberalism. And the Free Presbyterian Church of North America came into existence formally in 2005, just 3 years ago. This is the revival of what I call fundamentalist Presbyterianism, and that really completes the survey then of the whole range of Presbyterian history. And so you see as we come to the end that this history has as its focus the work that in which we are engaged now. We are part of that history. We are part of that development now. We are part of that call to stand for the faith of the gospel. And as so many have done before us in the way, we are called now to defend the gospel of Jesus Christ. We were singing earlier in this service this evening and thinking earlier in this service this evening of the precious blood of Jesus Christ. Here is the hallmark of the gospel. The Free Presbyterian Church has emphasized the preaching of the blood of Jesus Christ from its very inception. And that at a time when compromisers have sought to remove that emphasis. So we have been called to stand for the gospel. And like Asa was in the passage that we read at the beginning in 2 Corinthians 15, we are called to be strong. and not to let our hands be weak. We have a work in which we are engaged, a work to which we have been called. It is not a vain work. It's not a work that will leave us disappointed or confounded. It's a work that's going to be rewarded. This was the message to Asa. And here is the message to us this evening. At this point, near the end of the first decade of the 21st century, there is a work in which we have been called to engage, and this is a work that will be rewarded. And whatever the circumstances are, and however discouraging the prospects may appear to be to us, we are in Asa's position, hearing the words of the prophet, "Be strong, let not your hands be weak. Your work will be rewarded." And that's a word for me, it's a word for you, it's a word for all of the people of God. This is a time to press on. This is a time to continue on in this great work. And in the messages to come in this series, we're going to look at the doctrine that these heroic forefathers of ours were called on to defend. And that's the doctrine that we are called on to defend in our own time. These things are important. When I think back to the early years of my life, and I consider all the changes that have taken place, I have seen the harvest of compromise. I have seen the effects of what Billy Graham has done. You can see that all around us today. What's needed today is for those to stand up and say, we're not going to go down that road. We're going to stick with what our forefathers have defended. There's so much talk today about forgetting the past and looking to the future. But I say to you, the only way we can look to the future is by looking to the past and resolving that we too will be found faithful. Be strong then. Let not your hands be weak. Your work shall be rewarded, and Christ will be glorified.